Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you.
Anthony Fauci is pointing out that 3-4 million people a day being vaccinated. This, by the way, this after Donald Trump had said, no, we don't need any more than 100,000 doses. Remember he turned them down? Biden had to scramble like crazy to order more doses for the country. It's incredible. But Fauci says maybe no fourth wave. This is a big deal. Debbie Hines is going to be with us a little later on in the program, giving us an update on what's going on in the Chauvin trial, which is ongoing. But I wanted to start out with this kind of essential and fundamental question. Can depraved evangelical Christianity reform itself, or should it just go away? I mean, the Republicans and Donald Trump have thrown evangelical Christianity, and this goes back 40 years, but they've thrown evangelical Christianity into kind of a death spiral, at least, at the very least, a full-blown crisis. And Republican politicians are now doubling down on exploiting religious people. And it's now killing churches, as well as killing people, in a way that we haven't seen in living memory. I mean, we've watched absolute depravity wash across our body politic over the last couple of decades, right? Stolen election in 2000, being lied into 2 wars by Bush and Cheney. 4 years of a Trump presidency with literally nothing to show for it except for a huge tax cut for billionaires, the destruction of international relationships, thousands of children tortured, and 500,000 dead Americans. We had a president who raped women, who made fun of mentally disabled people, who tried to take away Obamacare, Social Security, Medicare, food stamps, and unemployment from American citizens, who intentionally tore America apart racially and religiously just for money and power. He ripped children from their mother's arms at the border. He tortured those kids for years, killing at least 7 of them. He called Nazi white supremacists very fine people. He tried to eliminate health care for poor Americans. He vilified refugees. And he did all this in the name of Christianity. I mean, let that sink in. Right on January 6th, when they attacked the Capitol building, a large contingent of that group knelt and prayed before they began killing people. The day before, on January 5th, there was a whole bunch of the same people, the quote Christians among them, who marched in circles around the Capitol chanting and praying, carrying giant wooden crosses. They called it their Jericho March because they thought that if they did this, it might cause the walls to come tumbling down the next day so they could invade the Capitol. And hey, it looked like it would work for a while, right? This is not what Jesus would have done. He was preaching morality, not politics. He was preaching spirituality, not politics. And the consequences of this are pretty stark. Back when I was born in 1951, the average number of Americans who went to church every Sunday was 73%. It hit a low when George W. Bush lied us into the war in Iraq. That was 65%. But for the first time in the memory of anybody alive today, It has now dropped below half. 47% of Americans go to church. That's amazing. I mean, organized religion is collapsing. And this is not the first time that religion has been corrupted by politics or vice versa. It's the first time in a really huge way. But this was a debate that went back to the founding of our republic. Jefferson and Madison had literally a years-long running debate about this in their letters and their correspondences. One of the results of it was Article 6 of the Constitution. There's no religious test. No person shall be subject to a religious test. Here it is, the exact language. No religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office of public trust under the United States. Any office of public trust, right? Dog catcher. You can't run for it as, or you can't say only a Christian, you know, only Christians need apply. But this was the big debate that they had. Jefferson was convinced that if a priest, his favorite phrase, but you know he meant that more broadly, ever became a major political figure in America, that our republic was at risk. Jefferson, of course, was an atheist and a deist. James Madison was a churchgoer. I think he was a Presbyterian, as I recall. And he was concerned about something quite different. He was concerned that if government started helping out churches, that it would corrupt the churches. And it turns out, and in fact, Madison was so concerned about that, that you know, his first veto when he became president in 1809, his first veto was to veto a law that Congress had passed to give money to churches in Washington, D.C. to run poorhouses. And he said, no, you can't do that. In fact, from his veto message, he said doing this would, quote, be a precedent for giving to religious societies as such a legal agency in carrying into effect a public and civil duty. He said instead the money has to go straight to the poorhouse, can't go through the churches. But all this really started in the 80s during the Reagan administration when Reagan hired the son of his vice president George H.W. Bush, that guy's son George W. Bush, hired George W. Bush as an outreach guy to the evangelical community. And this is when, you know, Falwell and Robertson and all these guys were really hitting their stride, and Jim Baker and Tammy Faye and their heated doghouse and their multi-million dollar mansions. And Reagan just welcomed these people in. I mean, we've had Jeff Charlotte on this program talking about this too. And they've been fleeced. Evangelical Christians for 40 years now have been fleeced by their own pastors, the ravening wolves among the sheep. And in fact, the single group in America that has the highest probability of saying, no, I won't get a vaccine, are white evangelicals. So where does this go? How does this play out? You know, in Northern Europe and Scandinavia, churches are pretty much empty on Sundays. They're mostly just places to get married and to go to funerals. They're way scaled back. Is that the direction we're heading? Would that be a good thing or a bad thing? I could argue either side of that, frankly. Are Republicans ever going to stop exploiting Christians for political gain? I mean, will the people of faith turn away from these modern-day Caesars who are reaching out their gnarled fingers, you know, to extract money from their pockets and votes from them? I mean, this corruption of religion over a 40-year period by the Republican Party, very intentionally, and the corruption of the Republican Party by a bunch of religious leaders who wanted power and money, has just brought the whole institution to its knees, the institution of religion. Now, granted, there is, you know, there are strong progressive churches in the United States, and many of them are doing just fine, thank you very much. But how's this thing going to turn out? When religious leaders are literally killing their own people.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
By lying to them about the vaccine. It's just mind-boggling. How does this play out? Sharon in Sonora, California. Hey, Sharon, thanks for watching us on Free Speech TV. Your thoughts on this?
Well, I've been saying for quite a while now that religion's the problem and not the answer. there's a big difference from my perspective between faith and religion. Religion, it needs people in fear and dread of others in order to survive. And that's how they get you in to save your soul, and they tell you put money in the till. And from my perspective, all of it is aimed at destroying, you know, the true relationship between ourselves and other life forms. And I just, I have been really upset about it for a long time. And I am, you know, a church goer in a way, from the perspective that I do have one of the religions I think you were just talking about, that I do admire and believe in the way it teaches religion or faith, what I call faith. And that is a belief in the wholeness of each one of us, and that everything gives to the other. It's all connected. Everything is all connected. And it can be almost proven, I think, in scientific ways. So I
yeah, what you're describing, Sharon, is in one way is Wicca, which is a religion. And it's a set of beliefs that are widely embraced among traditionally liberal churches, the New Thought movement, I don't think that that excludes, you know, these kind of traditional beliefs that we find mostly in indigenous societies.
Right.
Are not wholly rejected by most progressive churches.
Yes, and in fact, it's the faith of, you know, the church that I go to is Unity.
Yeah, Unity is probably the best example.
Yes, absolutely. That's what I believe, because that's how they handle their teaching, is all through the relationship of all things. But general religion and most all of them, and maybe Buddhism is the next one that I say close. In my searching out religions that don't kill each other, I discover that the Buddhists kind of do that too.
Until the crisis in Myanmar, formerly Burma, I don't believe that there had ever been a major campaign of extermination or warfare based on. There were Buddhists who executed those things, but in the name of Buddha, right? In the name of Buddhism. Right. And even this isn't so much in the name of Buddhism. It's just, you know, anti-Islam. It's because the Rohingya are Muslims.
Oy, oy, oy.
Yeah, I totally get it. Yeah, I think you're right. And I have always felt that way myself, that religion is, you know, it serves it can serve a useful purpose. But like anything else, you know, from a scalpel to a medicine, it can be used or it can be abused. And it seems to me that we've seen is the power, the potency of religion being seriously abused over the recent years. And I mourn that, frankly, as a person who considers himself not religious, but spiritual. Yeah, Sharon, thank you. Thank you very much. That was a very clarifying conversation there with Sharon. So let me just put a punctuation mark on some of this stuff and just clarify my specific thinking on it. This is all coming to a head right now, I think, in America, this whole issue of politics and religion, much like the issue of business and politics. I mean, you know, Mitch McConnell out there saying, well, you guys in the corporate world should just keep your noses to the grindstone and keep your mouths shut and keep putting money in our pockets. And basically, you know, the same kind of crisis is happening around religion. The Republican Party has exploited religion so much for the last 40 years, with like just transparent stuff, like, you know, oh, we have to have prayers before everything, and which is exactly the opposite, by the way. If you go back and read the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus said very clearly, you know, don't pray in public. Just don't do it. Every time I go to church and people want to pray in public, I feel uncomfortable. It's right there in the Sermon on the Mount. He says, go into your closet, close the door, and pray in secret. He said, if you pray in public, you know, you're just doing that for your own ego. He's unambiguous about it. But I think that this distinction that between religion and spirituality is a really important one. Religion offers a couple of things. And these are very, very powerful things. They're deeply embedded in our personness, in our inner world. One of those is community. For many people, their church is their community, or is the best part of their community. And that's a powerful thing. And so you have a church leader now who's not just a church leader, but also a community leader, and then they get political. And what does that do to the community? It has the potential to shatter the community, or it can turn the community psychopathic. This is how crusades happen. Right? This is what Osama bin Laden exploited in a different religion, but this is what, you know, it's all the same stuff. So number one, they offer community. Number two, a well-functioning church, you know, like the Unity Church that I used to go to years ago. It's been quite a few years since I've been in a church, but outside of ceremonial stuff, offered, and the SRF church that we used to go to, and the Coptic church, all of them offered an entryway, an access point, a touch point, a button into a spiritual experience. Not an angry experience, not a fearful experience, not a us-them experience, but a spiritual experience. I am convinced, you know, there's that book, The God Spot, years ago that said, that purported to have identified a part of our brain that when stimulated connects us to this feeling of oneness with all of the universe. And the theory was that as we die, that part of the brain activates and lights up and we merge we experience merging into the Godhead or into the consciousness of the whole entire universe. And, you know, it's kind of a cool thing. And apparently epileptics, people with epilepsy, experience this frequently. And so a lot of your mystics throughout history, and Joan of Arc, for example, was apparently an epileptic. St. Francis of Assisi. And perhaps St. John of the Cross. But whatever the mechanism is, I really believe, just from my own personal experience of having touched those moments of transcendence, both with and without entheogens, I think is the word, mind-altering drugs. I think that we're wired for this, right? We're wired for this sense of something greater than ourselves. I think it's right up there with love as just fundamental, or maybe it is another dimension of love. Love and the spiritual experience are like coming out of the same place. And the love that we feel for each other and for the people close to us is like a little piece of this larger experience that religion seeks to bring forward. And I think this is important stuff. We had, you know, I spent a week with a group of about 20 people with His Holiness the Dalai Lama back in 99, I think the year it was. Harrison Ford narrated a movie about it. It's called Dalai Lama Renaissance, a documentary. And we talked about this at some length with His Holiness, about the spiritual experience and Buddhism's constant quest for that spiritual experience. Or you could say non-quest, because one of the things he pointed out is, you know, the more you try, the less you get there, which is kind of talk about it's like a Rinzai Zen koan, you know, K-O-A-N, these thought puzzles that are so confounding that you end up, your brain goes tilt and you suddenly experience enlightenment. As opposed to Soto Zen, where you experience enlightenment through sitting and meditation. But I think that there's like really powerful stuff here in religion. Religion being the organized form of spirituality that we practice. There's really powerful stuff in there that the charlatans in the Republican Party and the money-grubbing televangelists got their hands on in a big way in the 1980s. I mean, you've got now, you know, billionaire. At multimillionaire televangelists. And it's not good for anything.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
It's not good for believers. It's not good for the country. It's not good for politics. It's not good for the churches. And now, because they're refusing to wear masks or take vaccines, it's killing people.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Hi, it's Tom Hartman Book Club, and today we're reading from What Would Jefferson Do? And this is from the chapter Warlords, Theocrats, and Aristocrats Rise Again, the subchapter Theocrats Attack Democracy. And the epigraph that we started the chapter with is from President Abraham Lincoln, where he said, "I am approached with the most opposite opinions and advice and by men who are equally certain that they represent the divine will. I hope it will not be irreverent of me to say that if it is probable that God would reveal his will on such a point so connected with my duty, it might be supposed he would reveal it directly to me." So the subhead of the chapter, America is a Christian nation. No, it's a nation where a lot of Christians live. And I read about Judge Moore and his Ten Commandments thing and his statement that, you know, America was founded in Christianity, and then proceed to share the founder's actual view on this. "Our founders were both well-schooled in the history of the Crusades and knew from firsthand experience with Puritanism how oppressive religious men could be, even with small amounts of political power. Ben Franklin fled Boston when he was a teenager, in part to escape the oppressive environment created by politically powerful preachers. And for the rest of his life, he was openly hostile to the idea of a secular power being wielded by those who hold also religious power. Although he was fascinated by the spiritual experience, Franklin had little use for the organized religions of his day. In his autobiographical Toward the Mystery, he wrote, quote, I have found Christian dogma unintelligible. Early in life, I absented myself from Christian assemblies, end quote. In his autobiography, Franklin talks about how he came to this way of thinking, quote, my parents had early given me religious impressions and brought me through my childhood piously dissenting in the Puritan way. But I was scarce 15 when, after doubting by turns of several points, as I found them disputed in the different books I read, I began to doubt of revelation itself. Some books against deism fell into my hands. They were said to be the substance of sermons preached at Boyle's lectures. It happened that they wrought an effect on me quite contrary to what was intended by them, for the arguments of the deists, which were quoted to be refuted, appeared to me much stronger than the refutations, and I soon became a thorough deist." End of quote. Franklin, like most of the more well-known founders, was a deist, subscribing to a philosophy made popular by Unitarians who held that the Creator made the universe long ago and has since chosen not to interfere in any way, that neither Jesus nor anybody else was divine, or alternatively, that we are all divine, and that there is only one God and not three. Another founding deist who resisted giving political power to those with religious power was George Washington. Jefferson's diary entry for February 1, 1799 reads, quote, when the clergy addressed General Washington on his departure from the government, it was observed in their consultation that he had never, on any occasion, said a word to the public which showed a belief in the Christian religion, and they thought that they should so pen their address as to force him, at length, to declare fidelity whether he was a Christian or not. They did so. However, Jefferson noted, the old fox was too cunning for them. He answered every article of their address, particularly except that which he passed over without even notice. Jefferson concluded that Washington, quote, never did say a word on the subject in any of his public papers, and that Governor Morris, a close friend of Washington's, has often told me that General Washington believed no more in that Christian system than he himself did, than Governor Morris did, end of quote, from Jefferson. In fact, President George Washington supervised the language of a treaty with African Muslims that explicitly stated that the United States was a secular nation. The treaty with Tripoli, worked out under Washington's guidance and then signed into law the next year by John Adams in 1797, reads, quote, As the government of the United States is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion, as it has in itself no character of enmity against the laws, religion, or tranquility of Muslims, and as the said states never have entered into any war or act of hostility against any Muslim nation, it is declared by the parties that no pretext arising from religious opinions shall ever produce an interruption of the harmony existing between the two countries, end of quote. But for the founders, this wasn't just an issue of being Christian or not. They didn't want any organized religion mixing its functions with government. For example, on February 21st, 1811, President James Madison vetoed a bill passed by Congress that authorized government payments to a church in Washington, D.C. to help the poor. Faith-based initiatives were a clear violation, in Madison's mind, of the First Amendment doctrine of separation of church and state, and could lead to a dangerous transfer of political power to religious leaders. Caring for the poor was a public and civic duty, a function of government, and should not be allowed to become a hole through which churches could reach and seize political power or the taxpayer's purse. Funding a church to provide for the poor would establish, in Madison's words, a legal agency, a legal precedent that would break down the walls of separation the founders had put between church and states to protect Americans from religious zealots gaining political power. Thus, Madison said in his veto message to Congress, he was striking down the proposed law because it helped a church to, quote, provide for the support of the poor and the education of poor children of the same, which, Madison warned, would be a precedent for giving to religious societies. That would be giving federal funds. Now, things have certainly changed since then with the faith-based initiative program that started under Reagan has now exploded. But anyhow, the book is What Would Jefferson Do? Yesterday, I tweeted out to Delta Airlines just a tip of the hat to their CEO for saying, finally, that the Georgia voter suppression law was based on a lie. His phrase, not mine, his phrase. The CEO of Delta, which is based, of course, in Atlanta, 33,000 employees in the state. But it appears that there's more to this law than even the shocking stuff that's been hitting the top of the headlines. And our good buddy and one of the best investigative journalists in the world, Greg Palast, is on the line with us. He's the author of How Trump Stole 2020, among many other great books. You can learn all about it at gregpalast.com. You can tweet him at Greg_Palast. Greg, tell us about this. What are the hidden horrors in the Georgia vote law that you wrote about today over at truthout.org?
So here's what's going on. In the 95-page SB 202, the Georgia anti-voter law, they put in two codicils which have really not been noticed. And I'm not talking about the story we talked about where I broke about how, you know, you go to jail for handing someone a slice of pizza. This is more important. Donald Trump asked the Secretary of State to find him 11,000 votes so he'd be president. Well, here's the deal. The Georgia legislature, the MAGA mob, has found 364,000 voters to remove in the next election. How are they doing this? In the bill, in this 95 pages, is a little provision that allows any voter in the state to challenge any other voter in the state and their right to vote in unlimited numbers. Now, what does that mean? There is and it's a real serious business because there's an organization out of Texas, a Tea Party spinoff called True the Vote, which during the Georgia U.S. Senate runoffs, are you ready for this? Challenged 364,541 voters, let me repeat that, a third of a million voters, and said that they should not be allowed to cast their ballots. Now, as you know, that would have changed the Senate and the presidency. 364,000 voters. Now, they said these were illegal voters, but you know what? Under Georgia law, before the election, you were allowed to challenge any voter where you had personal knowledge, like, oh, that guy's moved to Detroit. He shouldn't be voting here. They didn't have any information. They used a bunch of local shills to file this phony attack on a third of a million voters. Local elections boards, Republican, Democrat, it didn't matter. They all threw it out. They said, this is a joke. You don't know these people. You don't know a third of a million people. But the legislature decided this is a pretty nice trick. So they've now authorized, True the Vote, to file challenges, again, against more than a third of a million people, and to get over the objections of both Republican and Democratic county boards, which think that this is like nuts and a violation of federal law. They have said that the state board of elections, the brand new state board of elections, can replace and remove or overturn the decisions of the local boards. And who is this new state board? Under the new rules, it will be a representative of Brian Kemp, you know, the guy that shoplifted the election from Stacey Abrams, and representatives of the two houses of the Georgia legislature, both controlled by MAGA maniacs. So in other words, you will have the Trumpsters completely in charge, and they are taking the position that they can overrule these local boards and remove these people. And to add kind of a cherry on top of this satanic pudding, Brad Raffensperger, who is the Republican Secretary of State of Georgia, has literally invited True the Vote to challenge these voters. He's literally invited them, knowing, and he's even said, I mean, it was blank. In fact, the True the Vote, if you go to my Truth Out article today, which is just went up, if you go to Truth Out, you'll see a quote from Brad Raffensperger put out by True the Vote, who says, look, I have to follow federal law. I can't just remove voters. But True the Vote doesn't have to follow federal law. So if they challenge voters and I accept their challenges, hey, we don't, you know, that's one way around federal law. So he's literally inviting a group to help him break the law. 364,000 voters.
So let me get this straight, Greg, because the first thought that went through my mind is, okay, True the Vote challenges 300,000 voters, and Georgia says, okay, fine, you're challenged, so you can't vote or you get provisional ballots. I didn't hear you say that, though.
No, they said you're not going to get a provisional ballot. You get challenged. They have something called a challenge ballot. Now, if it's before election, the counties are supposed to send you a notice, some postcard that says you have to show up for like a court-like hearing. Can you imagine how many people, like Barbara Arnwine, probably the best voting rights lawyer in America, who's head of Transformative Justice Coalition? She's in a federal suit against the state with me and Black Voters Matter. She said, who's going to show up to take a day off work to go to a hearing to prove that they are who they are? This is nuts. Plus, right, under the new law, you can actually challenge people after they've mailed in their mail-in ballot. It's completely mad. But this is the way that they said they can get around Georgia law. Sorry.
What's to prevent you and me from creating a Truer the Vote organization and challenge 400,000 white suburban voters in Georgia?
Well, the problem is it's called the state board, the brand new MAGA State Board of Elections, which is just created under the new law, which says that the ultimate arbitrator will be five Republicans, pro-Trump Republicans, under the new law. They get the final say. So if you said, oh, let's get rid of the white guys, forget it. But if you say, let's get rid of the black voters, and as you know, we've discussed this many times, you know, they wiped out 198,000 voters before the last election due to actions of Black Voters Matter, I'm talking, and Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, which is the big Hispanic group. They called 40,000 people. They sent out 80,000 postcards. They got people re-registered. And that's why you have a different Senate and a different president.
Amazing.
The voters chose,
absolutely amazing.
Not the purgers.
Greg, you always bring something jaw-dropping to the table here. Greg Palast, gregpalast.com. Hey, Greg, thanks so much for dropping by today.
You're very welcome, Tom. Thank you. Bye.
Great talking with you. My question for you all listening is this. Hang on.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Will this work for Republicans? Or is this going to produce such a massive blowback that the GOP gets wiped out in 2022? Check in with Debbie Hines and find out what's going on in the Chauvin trial today. Debbie, trial lawyer, political commentator, former prosecutor, the Assistant Attorney General of Maryland early in her career. IamDebbieHines.com is her website, and IamDebbieHines is her Twitter handle. Debbie, welcome back. What happened today?
Thank you. So I think today we're actually starting to see where the prosecution is going. And what we're seeing is that they are putting on all of these police officer Minneapolis police officer witnesses to testify that, you know, Chauvin used unreasonable force He wasn't trained to use that neck restraint that he used. One of the witnesses even said, like, you know, they never even saw that maneuver that he used with Mr. Floyd's neck being held down with Chauvin's knee for 9 minutes, and that Chauvin had a duty to de-escalate the situation. Obviously, it was under control within a matter of a couple of seconds, so to speak, at the very longest, a couple of minutes, and that he had a duty as a police officer to regard the sanctity of life. So we're seeing not just previously Lieutenant Zimmerman, the oldest serving police officer currently in the Minneapolis Police Force, to the police chief yesterday, to the trainers, the two trainers today, and another officer who said, yes, and we do training, so we cannot blame it on the police force. So they're just really building a very compelling case so far on the use of unreasonable force, which is one of the aspects that they have to show.
So in the spirit of the notion that all they need is one wackadoodle juror to blow this case up with a hung jury, as I believe you explained to us yesterday, are the outlines of the defense becoming clear as a result of the cross-examination of the prosecution witnesses? And do we know when the defense is going to begin their case and who their witnesses are going to be, where they're going to go?
So we don't know when the defense is going to present their case. The court, the judge is keeping everything under wraps with that, and that's a very good sign because there's no reason for the witnesses on either side to be bombarded with the media and the press with questions before they testify. So we're not going to know when the defense is going to start and who the defense witnesses are going to be. You know, that has been the ruling throughout, just to keep some order and to hopefully not have a mistrial, because you can also have a mistrial in that way. But the defense is, you know, they're harping on the things they talked about before, that the crowd was a distraction, which has been refuted by the prosecution and the police officer. So they're supposed to be able to, you know, work with the crowd, and obviously this crowd was not a distraction. But they keep showing the defense. They keep showing a picture, the photo, the video, to show that there are different angles in the photo that would tend to suggest that Chauvin's knee was not on Mr. Floyd's neck, but was on his shoulder. That's some red herring that they're coming up with. It's not going to probably fly because we've already had the witnesses who were there. And everybody knows that if you take enough selfies, you can get the best possible look for yourself that you want. May not be what you look like in real life. So that's all that they're trying to show that. But I think that, and then the other thing they're working on is the totality of the circumstances, that yes, these are the policies, but things can change. They, you know, things can change on a moment's notice when you're policing, and I don't see that going anywhere. I think that their biggest shot, which is yet to come, is really dealing with the issue of causation, and that was sort of touched on today because they really want the witness that was in Mr. Floyd's car, who is an individual that the girlfriend had testified had given them drugs previously. They really want that person to testify as to what was Mr. Floyd's condition when he went back into the car, and to get into the whole issue of, you know, drug dealing.
Tell us what happened with this guy who was in the car with George Floyd. I think he's been kind of characterized as basically a local drug dealer, if I'm recalling that correctly.
Right. And, you know, Courtney Voss, who is George Floyd's girlfriend, I mean, she did testify about him, and they've already brought that out, that, you know, they did use drugs together. They tried to get over their opioid addiction, and sometimes they purchased drugs from this individual who just happened to be in the car on May 25th, 2020 with George Floyd. But that's just really on the defensive part, to try to get in the whole concept that Mr. Floyd did not die because he was held down with the knee, full weight of someone's knee on his neck for over 9 minutes, but it had something to do with the drugs, and the drugs in his system caused the heart attack. So at the end of the day, the witness that the defense would like to call is going to, his attorney has said he's going to take the Fifth Amendment because he sees where this thing is going to, that they're going to try to blame George Floyd's death on him.
Was he successful in requesting immunity?
Well, he doesn't get immunity because the prosecution doesn't want him. He doesn't get immunity. He's just saying he's going to take the Fifth, meaning you can ask me everything you want to ask me. I'm going to give you my name and my address and end it there.
I thought they were arguing for immunity. I must have misunderstood. Debbie Hines,
well,
you...
Well, he may have been.
Yeah, okay. I so appreciate your perspective and your experience on this and your willingness to come on and share with us. Thank you so much for these updates.
Thank you.
Debbie, great speaking to you. Debbie Hines, IamDebbieHines.com. I am Debbie Hines on Twitter. Michael in Memphis, Tennessee. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Just wanted to touch on your religion topic. Mm-hmm. Being from Memphis, like I told you, screening, we have churches on every corner here, literally. And mm-hmm. when you say that you're a Christian, and I had this conversation with somebody. He said, man, I'm a believer. I don't call myself a Christian. But listening to his point and looking at where we are, I'm black and I live in Memphis, Tennessee. And as you know, the Klan wasn't founded too far from here. Mm-hmm. Nathan Bedford Forrest had a statue here. He has a park here. And when you look at, well, you know, I'm a Christian, and a lot of horrible things have been done in the name of Christianity. You know, Manifest Destiny was done in the name of Christianity. It was mass murder.
I agree.
Slavery.
Yep.
In the name of Christianity.
Yep.
And people, when you have these conversations, and I tell people at work, like, look, we don't need to have this conversation here because you're inevitably going to say something stupid. Or, well, slavery wasn't as bad as you think, you know, because I'm a Christian and I don't want to hear that. And those are reasons why you have people that say, you know, I'm an atheist, because if the God you serve believes in the crap that you're walking around with, I guarantee you 90% of those idiots that was in Washington and did what they did at the Capitol building, I guarantee you 90% of them swerving down to Christians.
Yeah, probably 98%.
They beat cops, maced them. Yeah, 98%. They beat cops, maced them, you name it. They're Christians. And when you look at it, and when people have conversations like that about religion, you turn people off. And I had this conversation with people at my church. Again, Southern Baptist. The only things they care about at my church is abortion and homosexuality. Those are the only things they talk about. I'm like, okay, so I can beat my wife, cheat on her, have a baby with the mistress. As long as we don't abort that baby, I can still be a deacon, right? And they all look at me funny. I'm like, well, this is what people get from you. Because that's all you talk about. If you're gay, you're going to hell. If you have an abortion, you're going to hell. Well, what about if you cheat on your wife? What about you?
Yeah. No, I totally get it. And I completely agree with you, Michael. And that's why I'm trying to, that's why I say that I'm a Christian, because I think it's important for us to reclaim and reinvent that word, because it ain't going away. And,
right.
But I'll be right up front about what that means to me. And it means something very different to me than it does to, a lot of other Christians. Thanks for the call. And Janet in Mount Vernon, Washington, you're on the air, Janet.
I've heard it said that they will look back on this time as it being like a, I don't know, almost like a holocaust of animals. It's like they'll look back
yes.
in horror. I mean,
yes,
so,
I agree.
Speaking of horrors, I wanted to call about, and I've been debating about this for weeks and weeks and waiting for a Friday, but you're talking about religion, and I wanted to just mention the death cult of religions, and that would be the Pentecostal church. And I have, I was raised in that church until I was about 10. It scared me so bad. I would not go to church for years, and I realized that there are lots and lots of religions that do great things. Unfortunately, that was not the experience I had. I just had one of being terrified. I have a sister who's still a member of this church. She's gone down this rabbit hole, has been, you know, call me in the 80s, crying and weeping, telling me that, you know, the world was going to end, and she was so sorry for everything she'd done to me in my life, and blah, blah, blah. And of course, it didn't happen. You know, it was just some crazy pastor. But they're waiting for the rapture. That is what they're doing. That's why all this move around Jerusalem, and I wish that someone who had gotten away from this church had attended it far longer than I have, my condolences to them, but that they, you know, could call in with even more information. But the last call that I had with my sister, which was a couple of months ago, she was like, well, you know, I think we're going to come upon hard times. And I can't remember if this was before or after the insurrection at the Capitol that happened, but I feel like this is, when Chris Hedges refers to white Christian nationals, I feel like this particular group is what he is referring to. This is a rapidly growing religion with Hispanics, and it's very led by males, patrimony, so it's a very scary, scary religion.
Yeah, the Catholic tainted Pentecostalism and Yeah, I'm somewhat familiar with this, Janet. I, as a teenager, I attended the North Lansing Church of God briefly, and it was speaking in tongues and slaying in the spirit.
Oh, yeah.
All
you're
stuff.
Listening
it's amazing.
To Tom yeah. Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So, been there, seen that, and escaped it. We'll be back. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR, all into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. It's accessible from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/Hartman with two N's. netsuite.com/Hartman. That's netsuite.com/Hartman.
Today in our book club, we're reading from Reconstructing the Gospel, Finding Freedom from Slaveholder Religion by Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove with a foreword by the Reverend William Barber II. This is from page 61. The chapter is Living in Skin, and the subtitle is American Slavery and the Problem of Bodies. America's original sin of race-based slavery is rooted in our bodies. While most of us will do what we can to save our own skin, our bodies bear the curse of human rebellion, the sweat of the brow, and the pains of labor. The sins of our fathers and mothers bear down on bent backs and sciatic nerves. Slavery has always been one means humans employ to skirt this curse. To the victor belong the spoils is an ancient truism of war. Often in human history, the spoils include people. But war is not the only way some bodies become subject to others. In the opening lines of the Exodus story, the Bible says, quote, a new king to whom Joseph meant nothing came to power in Egypt, end quote. In the messiness of politics, favor comes and goes. But the people who are in power almost always make sure someone else carries the weight and does the dirty work. The unique contribution of slavery during the establishment of the American colonies was the employment of skin color to assign a class of people to perpetual servitude. Originally, white and black people came to the colonies as servants of the settler class, but race-based slavery emerged as an efficient means of building up the plantation economy by permanently assigning people of African descent to the status of slave. Africans who survived the long journey across the Atlantic Ocean, often chained to one another and packed prostrate in the hold of a ship, became human chattel in the New World. In explicit contrast to the enslavable black flesh of Africans, people of European descent began to imagine themselves as white. By virtue of their whiteness, and for no other reason, they imagined a divine right to own black bodies. For the people whose saleable skin rendered them subject to use and abuse, this arrangement was obviously anathema. Quote, and before I'd be a slave, I'd be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free, end quote, they sang when white folks weren't listening. Tactics of resistance varied, but people of African descent always knew in their bodies the basic heresy of race-based slavery. And in their bodies, white people knew it too. To comprehend the moral contradiction of America's original sin, you must consider what it meant for a young white man to come of age on a plantation. Imagine yourself growing up amid a pastoral landscape in the early 19th century, a half day's horse ride from the closest city. As for any child, your world is the people you've known and the places familiar to you since birth. The big house, which you've always called home, and the barn where your daddy tied a rope swing from the rafters so you could fly down from the loft and land safely in that mound of hay by the horse stalls. For as long as you can remember, you've always had your studies and your chores to do. Mother always insisted that you learn responsibility, but you always felt closer to Betsy, the enslaved black woman who changed your diapers and cooked your food and picked you up when you fell and skinned your knees. You never remember running down to the barn to play without Betsy's two boys and Imogen, the girl between them, the one that was born just 3 months after you.
For you, a son of so-called privilege, puberty means beginning to make sense of why you kissed Imogen down in the hay pile when you were six, and why you both always knew you could never tell a soul. It means coming to terms with the fact that you and Imogen both share your father's nose, and it means beginning to internalize an arrangement in which you will one day inherit as property the woman who both competed with your mother for your father's love and nursed you at her breast. If you were a good Episcopalian, as most plantation families were, this is also about the time you would be confirmed as a living member of the body of Jesus Christ. The Southern writer Lillian Smith wrote a century after slavery's end, "Now at one's feet there are chasms that had been invisible until this moment." Describing an experience shared in silence by generations of white Christians, she observed how, quote, "one knows and never remembers how it was learned that there will always be chasms, and now across the chasms will always be those one loves," end quote. To observe that race-based chattel slavery was a gut-wrenching experience that white people also experienced in their bodies is not in any way to equate their suffering with that of African Americans. It is instead to try to understand the lived experience that informs the ways they read the Bible and imagined their world. Because even though slavery ended in 1865 in the United States, most white Christians went on reading the Bible and seeing the world around them exactly as they had before. Growing up Southern Baptist in North Carolina, I memorized scripture in the King James Version and engaged in a serious program of discipleship as a white adolescent without ever giving serious consideration to the Southern in our denomination's name. Then in 1995, the summer before my freshman year of high school, the Southern Baptist Convention issued an official apology for its endorsement of slavery. There it was. We'd separated ourselves from our American Baptist sisters and brothers some 150 years earlier in order to stay Southern and keep our slaves. Enough water had passed under the bridge for our elders to decide it was time to bury the hatchet. They said they were sorry. But their concession stirred up old fears. Before I'd finished high school, a conservative movement within the denomination insisted we had become too liberal, took over the denomination, and forced everyone who worked for the International Mission Board to sign a statement of faith to which they added an article about female submission. It was the first time in my life I'd seen people on the local evening news being interviewed about my church. The book, Reconstructing the Gospel. And welcome back. Mary in Bainbridge Island, Washington. Hey, Mary, what's on your mind?
Oh, hi. I was listening to all this with the spiritual stuff. I grew up as a Unitarian at the age of 10. And so a lot of this stuff was very different from what I grew up with as far as it wasn't religion. It wasn't any of the things you're talking about. But one of the things I learned at the Unitarian Church up here in Washington State was from a woman who was from the liberal religious youth in Massachusetts. And those were the people that they passed the law against prayer in schools, and the atheists took over that and tried to make it theirs. But I just wanted to say that it was the Unitarian kids who actually passed that law, and then eventually it turned into the Unitarian Universalists. And they were, yeah, I think it's really important people understand that it was not a Christian church. They did not believe in Jesus as the Son of God. They believed that God would suffer from that.
Yeah, so the Unitarian Church has a... Well, thank you, Mary. The Unitarian Church has an extraordinary history. I mean, they were singled out for persecution. They were rendered illegal in Massachusetts in the 1600s and the early 1700s, and still persecuted well into the 1800s, the early 1800s, in that state and in several other parts of the United States. I said earlier that I haven't been in a church in years. I should correct myself. Louise and I, in addition to sitting Zazen, going to a Zen temple regularly for quite some time, also when we used to live in Portland before this current iteration, we used to attend the Unitarian Church here in Portland. It's in downtown. And I mean, not real frequently. I've probably been there a dozen times, but, you know, for Sunday services. But it's... It's nice to have community. It's nice to have fellowship with people who are seeking spirituality, but also seeking a better world, you know, a better connection with other people and trying to be supportive of each other. And that was always my sense of the Unitarian Church, that it was community first, right, and everything else second.
Yes, and it was the unity with all living beings.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Yes.
And
also,
you know, not, I'm yeah. sorry.
Oh, I was thinking of the woman who had, we had a Pentecostal minister who got thrown out of the church because he was gay, and he made our church very spiritual and lots of singing and stuff. So it was wonderful.
That's great.
Anyway, thanks.
Mary, I got to run, but thank you. Thank you. And we'll be right back. It's coming up on 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. What an absolutely fascinating day, huh? Cesar in Chicago, Illinois, or is it Cesar? You are on the air.
Actually, you're right. It says that, but Cesar's fine. Thanks for taking my call. I'm glad we're talking about religion because it's something I want to ask you for a while. I'm a very proud Catholic, you know, by born and definitely by choice now. And I definitely see myself as progressive, meaning I definitely believe a lot in science and have a very strong faith. And there's a lot of people keep asking, how can 32-33% of Latinos have voted for Trump? And obviously, a lot, hypocrisy has a lot to do with it. But the number one thing that I've talked to too many people is religion. They mm-hmm. just blindly focus themselves. And people could say, like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. But they don't understand. There's a lot of very good people that are very good neighbors. They're very good, very clean in the neighborhood. But that's all they just focus on. It's just abortion and people being gay. It's all they just focus mm-hmm. on, just the horrible thing. They're like, oh, two males having sex. And then, which is the least thing about people that are gay. I don't know that many gay people, but I have zero problems with any of them at all compared to a lot of hypocrites that they claim to call themselves Catholic as well. So my question to you, Tom, is how can I get through to them? And again, I'm not in the convincing people business, you know, because some of them are just stubborn. And I know there's no one liner, but what can I tell them to make them understand that they're really prosecuting themselves by saying that they're saying that it's their faith that are making them vote for all these nut job Republicans? Like, how can I get
well,
through
them? Yeah, first off, we now have the nation's second Catholic president. John Kennedy was the first. So if somebody is largely identifying as Catholic, I would say something like, hey, isn't it cool that we actually have a practicing Catholic in the White House? You know, Trump never went to church, but Joe Biden literally goes to Mass every single week. And he refers to his religion.
It's almost 60 years. If you think about it, it's almost 60 years to the day that we had John JFK and Joe Biden as president.
Yeah, yeah, it's amazing. But that might be an entry point. I mean, you know, the old lesson of, you know, trying to reach people where they are is first you have to figure out where they are and then kind of, you know, hang out there a little bit. And so if somebody is like, well, I'm a Catholic and Catholicism teaches X, Y, you know, is opposed to abortion, and so I'm going to vote Republican because Republicans are opposed to abortion. Well, how about voting Democratic? Joe Biden, while he's opposed to abortion personally, he doesn't think that the government should be playing a role in that, which, by the way, was Jesus's position. Remember, render unto Caesar what is Caesar and unto God what is God's. I'm kind of happy that we've got a Catholic in the White House. It'll be interesting to see what impact that has, because Cesar, you are absolutely right. The Hispanic community, the Latinx, the Latino, however you would characterize yourself and your community, is heavily Catholic. I mean, overwhelmingly Catholic. And I think religion is a huge factor in this stuff. And I've also caught some of the Catholic radio stations. I've seen clips of Catholic radio stations. I used to listen to one when we lived in Detroit years ago. They used to do the rosary every morning. I would listen to this. But they're pitching Trumpism, some of them. And it's like, whoa. And I understand that there's a lot of this going on with Spanish language radio. Do you know about that?
There is a couple stations that we do listen to here in Chicago, and they really, I really haven't heard anything Trumpism. It's, understand. I know that there's some from Texas. I have family in Houston where they tell me that they do listen to once in a while. You know, they it's the same lingo. I mean, you could catch it a mile away. It's like word for word, like with their blinders on. They just keep repeating the same thing, and then we got to expose. Like, oh, as soon as you hear that, it's got to hit you, click in your head. That's not true. You're lying. That's BS. You know, but here in Chicago, we're pretty open. We're pretty diverse. We're pretty proud, and we're pretty progressive to the most part.
That's good. At least from my point of view, that's great. This is Art. Thank you very much for the call. Mark in St. Augustine, Florida. Mark, we only have about 40 seconds to the end of the show.
Okay. All right, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to follow up on what somebody said about Cindy Hyde-Smith, which was the thing she said about voting on the Sabbath.
Right. Black people shouldn't vote on Sundays. Right.
But the Sabbath in Exodus would be Saturday, wouldn't it?
Right, which is short for Sabbath day, by the way. Yes, you're absolutely right.
Yes, exactly. That's what somebody on Michelangelo Signorelli's show pointed out a while back, and I'm like, somebody should, I don't know.
Tap her on the shoulder and inform her, perhaps. you go. Mark, thank you. Thank you. That's a great one. So thanks so much for being with us today. We will be back tomorrow, same time, same place. In the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires you. Every single one of us, we have to show up. Otherwise, it's not a demos. It's not the people, right? It's not we the people. So get out there, get active, tag, you're it, and have a great afternoon. Be good to yourself and the people around you, especially the people around you. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.